RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, joined as always by my friend and comrade, Danny Bessner. And we are very pleased to welcome to the program Borzu Daragahi. He is a longtime foreign correspondent, writer of the newsletter Badlands at borzu.substack.com. We'll have a link to that in the show description. Borzu, thank you so much for coming on the program.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So we wanted to talk to you about the death of journalism, basically. Yeah. I don't want to be morbid about it, but death of international journalism, at least. You wrote a piece for your Substack that really resonated with me. Your podcast leeches off my news outlet. We will also have a link directly to that piece in the show description. But it put me in mind of something. And we did an interview a few months ago with Mike Duncan, the History of Rome podcast, or, you know, did History of Rome Revolutions. And we did it because we were talking about the death of, like, humanities in the university because of a Twitter exchange that he had that would very much reminded me of your Substack piece. Basically, some Twitter rando was like, why do I need books on the history of Rome? I can just listen to Mike Duncan's podcast. Oh, like, why do I need all these professors in these universities? And, you know, he jumped in and said, I don't know where you think I get the material for my podcast comes from. But, like, this is the same idea, basically, that people have somehow separated content from the substance that underpins that content. So talk a little bit about what you were thinking when you wrote the piece.
I mean, I think it's even worse, you know, than what you're saying. It's not like that they're just ignoring it. They're actually actively trashing it, you know. So they go and, you know, like daily, you know, and the example that I cited was, you know, Jimmy Dore, this podcaster, and literally the theme song of the TV show that he, the show that he has goes like, establishment media sucks. It's all gaslighting. And so good luck. And, you know, he trashes the MSM every chance he gets. He's not alone. You have, you know, all the other podcasters as well, Joe Rogan, et cetera. Funny enough, and I'll put a little note on this, is like Nick Fuentes does this too, but he actually doesn't, even though he's considered this really toxic guy, but he's actually somewhat respectful of the work of the media. But you have these guys, they spend their whole half of the show, it seems sometimes, is trashing the coverage of the international media. And the other half, especially in the case of Jimmy Dore, is actually just sitting there reading, you know, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph from that same mainstream media that they've just, you know, trashed. So it's like where do you think your understanding of what is happening in the world even comes from? You know, you know, someone has to be in at the press conference in the White House. Someone has to set up the camera. Someone has to pay for that. Someone has to, you know, buy lunch that day for the crew when they're, you know, out on a reporting assignment at a hurricane site. You know, someone's got to pay the salary of the fixer in Venezuela when they're trying to get some reportage on the ground about how the U.S. Military action is affecting that country. And you're taking advantage of this. You're, you know, trashing the media. You're urging people to listen to your podcast instead of subscribing to, you know, the New York Times or Washington Post or you know, relying on the Associated Press for news. And meanwhile, you're totally dependent on them.
I mean, there's a criticism. There's certainly, you know, to criticize the way that some of these outlets cover some stories. Like, I can criticize the way the New York Times covered Gaza. I think it was an abomination on many levels, you know, some of the stories that came out of that newspaper. While at the same time respecting the fact that if the New York Times didn't have an international reporting desk, like, there would be a vast number of stories that we would just never hear about. Like, it would be a net loss to, you know, certainly to this show and to, you know, the newsletter that I write, in terms of, you know, if you think about the content industry, but just in general, it would be a loss. I think the criticism of the specific decisions that get made or the specific ways that things are covered bleeds somehow. It's very sloppily kind of bleeds into just like, this all sucks. Everything, you know, all journalism just sucks in general, and we don't need it, and we can get rid of it. Is that, does that sort of feel like what you're seeing?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, there's a kind of vacuum that is there already. Do you know, when I first started in this business, you know, the Baltimore Sun had foreign correspondents. You know, the New York Star Ledger put me on retainer in Iraq and Iran and, you know, Afghanistan and so on. They put, you know, these local regional, the San Francisco Chronicle would take my stories regularly. And, you know, they had a foreign editor, and so on. And then that went to an international / national editor. And that went to, like, basically just taking the wires. And so there's already this cavern of coverage. So where, you know, where do you think you're getting your news from? Where do you think let's say there's a report about a you know, genocide in Sudan that no one is covering enough. Where do you think you even know about that? You know, do you really think that, like, social media and some activist in London is going to give you the kind of disinterested, balanced coverage of something as complicated as a civil war in at that corner of Africa, as opposed to the news wires or the New York Times and so on. And so it's really gotten so harsh in terms of the original reporting, original source reporting that feeds the news industry. That goes for it used to be just the vacuum used to be felt mostly in international news. Now it's being felt also with the Washington Post's, I don't know what to call it, massacre of the news desk there with national news. And increasingly as well with, and it's been talked about for a long time, with the death and consolidation of newspapers with local news as well.
Yeah, I mean, not talked about. Danny, I know you have a question, but just to, like, jump on that, like, you know, the international desk getting axed, and I want to go through these recent events more systematically, but just with the Washington Post, like, there was a lot of attention I saw paid to the international desk, but they like gutted the Metro department. I mean, there's like 12 reporters left at that newspaper covering the entire DC area, which is, you know, 6.5 million people or whatever the figure is. It was just shocking, like the extent of the cuts to that section of the paper.
And I want to jump in because I think this raises really big questions about the role of the press, and particularly the role of the capitalist press in American society. And there have been criticisms that have been made from the so-called Global South, back when it was the Third World, about the problem of relying on profit-seeking as a means to get your news. Now, there's lots of problems with relying on the government to also fund the papers. So I'm not saying that there isn't, but it seems to me that particularly with the Bezos firings at the Washington Post, the destruction of the American newsroom, and essentially doesn't exist as a career any longer, really foundational questions about the role of whether you could actually have a capitalist press are not only being raised, but they're being answered. And the question is, no. If you have this sort of press that over time, this is what it tends to. It tends towards the New York Times essentially being a recipe booklet with a news organization attached. And that is effectively by far the most robust news organization in America as well. We've seen the closing of all of these local papers. We've seen even the big three, like the WAPO, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, particularly the WAPO, obviously has closed down. So it seems to me that we're actually at a moment where you need to think about the structure of news and how, going forward, if there is you know, a future for this society, we rethink how we actually fund news. Because we're in this strange moment where there's sort of a blend of the Cold War consensus media, mass media organizations holding on, the New York Times essentially being the only one. And then a return to almost a progressive and pre-progressive era news media, where like every town has 14 newspapers to your own very specific ideological persuasion. Like if you go to these old West towns, it's wild. They have three newspapers. You know, there's 400 people in town and there's three newspapers. So I think this is, I'm curious your thoughts about structurally, where do we go from here? Because clearly relying on billionaires is not stable. Ads are no longer going to be here to save us. Subscription model is not going to work because everyone can't subscribe to 400 Substacks and newspapers. So I'm at a loss of where we go, but that's a big question, but I just wanted to raise the type of structural issue that I think we're facing here.
Well, I mean, I would just interject that I think that, you know, billionaires have done in the past okay jobs with newspapers, and as long as they saw it as kind of a, you know, public trust, a kind of philanthropic exercise that they are engaged in, and you know, we're
but that's
doing
gone
this
away.
For their own PR. Yeah, but
that's
you know what
away.
Happened though? Why did you know Bezos changed? I mean, something happened to him. You know, if you, because I remember watching him during when the Jamal Khashoggi thing happened, and I think something happened to the billionaire class in general in this country, and that happened to him. But in 2018, he was so good on, you know, one of his columnists was murdered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was really good on that, and he seemed to really put out statements and comments that emphasizing his support for the Washington Post as a public trust and so on. And then the pandemic happened and all these billionaires went crazy. Something happened to them during that time that made them believe in this kind of much more cynical. I think at some point he dumped his wife, he redid his face, and he came out this kind of James Bond figure, all of them are, who basically do not believe in civic life anymore. And are heading our world towards. I think the root of that problem is linked to the root of the billionaire issue is also part of the journalism issue and the media issue, is that we have an elite that doesn't have any care whatsoever for civic life, might actually see civic life as a detriment. You know, they're not contributing to operas. They're not contributing to, you know, as in previous gilded eras. They're basically buying massive boats and hobnobbing with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago.
So that just indicates, I think, the problem of relying on an elite. And also Let me just very quickly. Sure. So people always reference the Carnegie libraries. He would buy the libraries, but not the books. So what you actually had was a lot of empty buildings. So I think that says a lot.
I think this is another data point in my thesis that we have the worst oligarchs of all time today. Like these are the worst of all time. Sorry, Danny, go ahead.
No, that's what I was going to say. So they did build the operas, but let's not gild their lilies too much.
You know, I was just going to say there are all these with respect to your original question. There are all of these initiatives in international coverage. You know, national news is almost glutted with various, you know, columnists and self-starting, in the U.S. at least, self-starting reporters who are doing cool stuff and putting it out on Substack or you know, on other social media tools and so on. There are a lot of initiatives, and internationally there's a lot of local initiatives, there's a lot of international initiatives, there's these projects, there's possible collaborations and so on. I have been with newsroom leadership as we have examined some of these over the years at the LA Times, at the FT, at BuzzFeed News, even at the Independent. And there was like talk of kind of how do we incorporate this cool idea into our coverage? For example, a little initiative, let's say in the suburbs of Paris, that covers France in a really cool way. You know, how do we bring that on? And what always became the case is that the editor, there were so few editors, and as the staff was being cut, there was literally no managerial capacity to, you know how it is when you like, you want it, you don't even have the capacity to hire an intern. you know, yeah, you have a little bit of money for an intern, but you don't have the enough management to even train that intern or, you know, keep them happy and give them assignments because you're so short staffed. And that's what happened to newsrooms. They got cut so to the bone that even management didn't have the capacity and doesn't have the capacity to think up some creative ways of doing coverage and then overseeing those creative ways.
I mean, it really is to you know, both of your points, like the Substack model, which I'm using broadly to talk about like these interesting, in some cases interesting, some cases not, but people who are doing kind of localized work. You can't recreate the aggregate effect of what a newsroom can do. And you can try to come up with some hybrid solution. But, you know, to your point, Borzo, there's just no capacity in any of these places to do that kind of work anymore. It's a real problem. I mean, you think about, you know, I've had people ask me, especially in the wake of what happened at the Washington Post, like, you know, can't we just rely on, you know, the sort of newsletter universe to recreate what these places did? And the answer is no. Like, unless you're prepared to subscribe to, as Danny said, like 400 Substacks, you're not going to recreate the work that the international desk at the Washington Post was able to do if you want a broad spectrum, you know, journalist, you know, looking at things that are happening around the world. So, yeah, it's a very difficult thing. What I worry about even more than this is talking about some of the interesting, you know, local work and thinking internationally, like some of the things that are happening in Sudan or in, you know, in other places where people are on the ground kind of doing their own reporting and that's getting out to some degree, is it's all going to get hoovered up by these language models, right? I mean, isn't this the other challenge here, that AI is just going to suck in the way that search engines did, you know, did a number on news outlets, or Facebook did a number on news outlets? Like, AI is the next cut of this. It's just taking people's work and, you know, reprocessing it and disconnecting it from the writer.
Yeah, and again, that will have the same result if there is no way to make a living in the model that you propose, this sort of local journalism model, you know, of this person who, let's say, this hypothetical team of people covering the suburbs of Paris, for example. If, you know, AI, if ChatGPT is just gobbling all of that stuff out and regurgitating, and I use that word, you know, with contempt for what the AI language models do, and regurgitating that as its own content, then no one needs to subscribe to, you know, I think it was called the Bondi blog, the initiative that I was thinking of, that, you know, the LA Times was once considering. And there's no reason to do that. So again, you're basically killing off any incentive. I mean, it takes, as we know, as everyone knows, and I hope people who are watching and listening know, it actually takes time to do reporting, and it takes work to do reporting. And it's like to actually, and it costs money to do reporting. You have to make calls. You have to, you know, take taxis to here and there. You have to perhaps hire a fixer because you're going into a part of a city that, or a country that is, you know, not amenable to just walking in there. You have to have someone who helps you out there. And all of these cost money, and it costs money to stay in a hotel, no matter what a dirty hotel it is, what kind of low-end flea bag hotel it is, it costs money. And so, you know, when you take any kind of financial incentive out of that, it becomes impossible. I'll give you an example. You know, I last time I was unemployed was like for a brief period in 2018, and I would freelance, and, you know, it was kind of cool, and I was all right, you know, for a few months there before I went from, when I went from the BuzzFeed to the Independent, I was freelancing from Istanbul, and it was possible to, you know, do two or three articles a week, make a grand or so, you know, and have something of a living. And now I'm looking, and they're like, you know, it's the, first of all, they're paying the same amount as they were. There's fewer places like the Atlantic or Foreign Policy and so on. They're paying less money. So basically, effectively less money as they were before because of inflation, as we all know. And they would be like, okay, I can go to, let's say, this part of Turkey and report there for a few days and come up with a story about how the, you know, Kurds are doing whatever in their fight against the Turkish state. Be like, great, that's awesome, that's fantastic. $300 for that. you know, no expenses. Or I could sit there and do a quick take on like Erdogan and his relationships to Hamas. Same thing, $300. So essentially, you're basically taking any incentive out of doing any actual journalism and pushing people towards this commentary model that doesn't actually break news, but is just like quick takes and so on. But, you know, in the world, in the universe of clicks and page views, it doesn't make any difference to them, to the publishers right now.
And to me, this is yet another artifact of the coming apart of that mid-century consensus that we always talk about on this show. I mean, say what you will about the Cold War liberals, but they had a vision of the world, and they really thought the United States was going to push capital H history forward and really contribute to progress and actually help people, and you would have social welfare at home. And basically, since the 1960s, for both good and bad reasons, that consensus has come apart. And I don't think it's for nothing that a lot of these international desks, to my knowledge, I'm not an expert, but a lot of these international desks really emerged in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which was the moment when the United States became a genuine global power. And there was the belief that the public needed to be aware of what was going on in the world. So Trump is yet again another artifact of this, where like you just have the power without the type of Gramscian hegemony, without the notion that like Trump does not care if other people in the world want the United States to govern them. Yeah, there's no consent. And so basically, you see the end of the international desk at the same moment when this belief that the United States should have an abiding interest in the world and the public should care about the world, it's all coming apart and being replaced with Wordle and recipes. And so this is, again, sort of this another consequence of this disintegration of this Cold War model that really emerged in the wake of the mass experience of World War II. And I think you see, in the absence of any sort of mass experience, things just come apart, and they come apart basically, I guess, within 100 years almost. And so the problem is that I don't see another consensus emerging. Like, the best we have in our politics is that you kind of just fuck over your enemy. That's the limit of our political vision. Like, we always talk about on the show how Trump is not trying to create a hegemonic consensus, for example, ICE deportations. The thing is just to hurt your enemy. And so from there, I don't see how we have a revived or revivified news organization. You know, we have a billion Substacks that, you know, are minor, and we're part of this problem or the solution, Derek. I don't know whatever hire us, because we're way too critical. I heard someone refer to us as a left-wing, almost communist foreign policy podcast on Bob Wright's podcast, friend of the pod, Bob Wright.
Yeah, I
mean, where we go. Sorry, Derek, please.
Well, I mean, I think the reason that, you know, Borges' piece hit me so hard is because, like, I mean, we do sometimes criticize the way that things are covered, but if there was, if all of these things go away, if the Washington Post goes away, AFP is now the latest one, I think. I don't know if you saw that, Borges, that's cutting, which is terrifying, because that's a wire service. I mean, you hope that the wire services would be like the last one standing, but like if it's even affecting wire services, that's really dangerous.
Each other, right? They see that Washington Post is doing this. This has always been the way, you know, and they say, okay, I think we need to downsize as well. They see that as a signal.
Right. And I mean, I just, like, you know, how are we going to do this show? Like that's the level I'm thinking of. Like, you know, we depend on this stuff to a great degree.
I mean, I think perhaps if we, you know, if there is a sort of reverse engineering of some of these news organizations, you go back to the original sin of these news organizations being consolidated by these, you know, kind of corporations, it turned into parts of media conglomerates. And if you were to redo that, you would sort of have a model like The Guardian that would avoid that possibility of being the Guardian UK, of being, you know, sucked up by a big corporate power. And what those big corporations do once it gets into that game, and I know a little bit about this kind of stuff, it gets, you know, it gets either bought up by private equity or bought up by, you know, some other entity that loads it up with debt, sees this as an opportunity to, you know, they don't buy it outright. They, you know, they buy it with debt, and then they, you know, burden that news outlet with the debt. And so then it becomes, it becomes necessary for that news outlet to produce enormous returns. You know, I mean, these news outlets, Tribune Company, all these ones that basically died out, not yet, but they're dying out. They were always churning out like a little modest profit, you know, 6-7%. 5%, but it was not enough to cover the debt that they were saddled upon by private equity and corporate robber barons, essentially. So you would reverse engineer that. You would keep the bean counters away. I mean, one of the things I noted in my piece there, and I think that it's a little bit controversial, but I don't think that news organizations need to spend so much money on security. I think that this is an artificial expense that's been added on by layers of management and bean counters who are justifying their own salaries, just as HR sort of creates this layer of bureaucracy to maintain itself and creates all these rules and all these trainings that you need to do to like hire their friends and so on. So you have this sort of security industrial complex of ex-SAS and ex-US military people who are glomming onto these, news organizations, ex-Israeli military people as well, glomming onto these news organizations, convincing them that they need to do this. And then once they get into the news organization, they demand this. So as I noted in that piece, at some point, it was costing news organizations $15,000 a week to keep a correspondent in Ukraine just for insurance costs. Now, why is that? Why do they need that? Why can't they come up with their own insurance structure that's more cost effective? It's because they have a security outfit attached to the news organization saying that if we don't do this, we're opening up ourselves to liability. And once you get that guy in there, you essentially, if something does happen and you have fired that guy, the insurer or the defendant or the plaintiff rather in that particular case, if something happens, can say, hey, you had the security guy there. So they got themselves into this trap. So our new model news organization would not fall into that trap.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned a little earlier, because this is a long time trend in media, from what I can tell, which is the preference for commentary over actual reporting. This is something that happened to cable news a long time ago, where everything just became these interminable panel discussion shows or interviews with very little actual reporting or news happening. And it feels like this has just bled into newspapers now and other types of outlets. But maybe we could talk about this in the context of a couple of things. First of all, like the ultimate example of this to me is now the decision to blow $80 million on Melania's documentary as opposed to, keeping the Washington Post functioning because they're both coming out of Jeff Bezos's pocket. But also, you talked about this in your piece, what's happening at CBS, where Barry Weiss is telling journalists, actual reporters, to take buyouts if you don't like what we're doing, so that she can bring in her roster of like right-wing supplement grifters and people who are in the Epstein files and all these other, like her friends from the University of Austin. And so, can you just talk about this like preference for commentary, which is cheaper, it's easier to do, it's probably economically more viable, but it's like, again, another thing that's based on journalism, but it's happening at the expense of journalism.
I mean, exactly. So, yes. And this is one of the things that, made me really depressed. And when I was telling you about how it didn't make any difference to the news organization if I would spend a week reporting something out or if I would just quickly bang out some kind of quick take in a day, it didn't make any difference to them. This is what happened, I think, in large part and I saw this happen at the Los Angeles Times, when the news organization started handing editorial decisions to the, web people. I mean, when they started handing editorial decisions to the people who were monitoring web traffic and so on. And so this ugly cycle began when they started basically assigning news stories based on traffic and what was hot, what was, this whole, they don't talk about SEO anymore, but like now they talk about it. So, yes, if you do a story that has Ferrari and pornography in the headline, it's going to do a better one that has one about, Darfur and genocide. Yes, it will do better on the web. But if you put the person who's monitoring that in charge of editorial decisions, you're taking the path that's going to lead to hell. And I told the people at the LA Times that you're going to regret this decision down the line. And I remember basically saying that you hand the editorial decisions on what articles we write to that person, we're going towards a very dark direction. So yes, and so that, it started with that, and so now you have, you know, this this like addiction almost to content instead of articles or stories, content that grabs attention, that creates engagement. Well, you know, we're animals. What creates engagement is like what, you know, the pleasures of life, you know, sex, fast cars, food, etc., you know, games, trivial stuff that, and so on. So if once you go down that road, then yeah. And then what happened, I think, to some extent is that even that commentary is like, what is the hot commentary of the day? It's very rare that you see something that is produced by a news organization. I mean, New York Times is a good barometer because you see less and less stuff that's not tied to the daily news cycle, you know? And it takes time to report something out. It takes time to write something kind of thoughtful. So it's just become this kind of, instead of news, we have this quick take industrial complex where you just have these like thought pieces. And I saw that also, if I may, just cut me off if you want me to shut up. But I saw that also at the FT, where there was like more and more and more at the Financial Times, more and more emphasis on, you know, thinly reported, incisive, thoughtful pieces, and less emphasis on reporting from the ground, to the point where essentially they have stopped basically doing kind of reporting on the ground. It's all just like scoops acquired by phone, the quicker the better. You know, if you can just get the journalism, a lot of the business coverage is just some investment banker leaking them something about some IPO that's coming up, and that's exclusive. That's the big, huge thing, versus actually investigating whether this company that is having an IPO is legitimate and whether there's any substance there. So this is like the consequence of the speed of the addiction to the algorithm, the speed of the news content that's coming out, and the emphasis on engagement versus quality.
Well, it's a consequence of profit seeking, and that this is the problem, right? Like this is the people have been making the margins, this criticism, yeah, for 50, 60 years, that ultimately this is what you're going to arrive if you have a news based on profit seeking. So I just don't see how, again, this, you know, this is always a left-wing criticism. All we need to do is reform the entirety of society and we'll get a functioning news organization. That's it. But, you know, the consequence of the fast news, it's also much, much cheaper to pay, you know, some 26-year-old to write a hot take than there is to pay someone with decades of experience to go and do reporting on the ground. And the algorithm is geared towards these dopamine hits because it's geared towards getting as much profit as humanly possible. So, I mean, this is where we always arrive at. There's no solution because it's not going to change, because it's not, society is not going to be overhauled. So we're just going to have these capitalist incentives that prey on the worst of humanity. And sort of, like you said, we're animals, the worst of the animal spirits that define us. And so we're never going to have good news organizations. And it just turns out that historically, you have to have a confluence of like very random factors, the mass experience of World War II, which led to a genuine commitment to a global national project, which at least lasted for several decades, for you to have functioning mass news organizations. And we don't have any of that. So now it's just everyone is out for themselves, and that's it. And so, like, I truly don't see how we get anything approaching what we had in the 20th century. I think it's just going to be decay and decomposition more and more and more, worse and worse. And then you're going to have the few Mr. Beasts who rise to the top, and then everyone else is going to be immiserated, barring some gigantic, I don't think violent revolution is possible or even perhaps desirable, but some sort of transformative process that basically changes everything that we've organized our society around. And the news and the media is just a function of that. So I mean, I am totally hopeless on any of this getting reformed in any genuine way.
It was shocking to see Bezos, I mean, to the point about past, you know, billionaire newspaper owners kind of seeing it as a civic trust, or, you know, we can debate that. But like for Bezos to make the statement that he did after the bloodbath at the Post and just say outright, like, the data tells us what people want to read, and so we're going to follow the data and just, you know, pour more slop into the bucket, basically. Like, we're not going to try to cover the things we think are important. We're just going to give people what they want, which is, you know, just
just takes you further down the cycle into, you know, everything is like sex and sports, basically.
But then we get back to this dilemma where, you know, I mean, you know, there's so much demand for that quality content, as shown by, as demonstrated by the millions of Substacks of news analysis, serious stuff out there that are making okay money, some of them, as shown by, you know, the biggest podcasts that are out there. You know, I mean, I watched Nick Fuentes, something, this, you know, far right guy. I mean, his show is so dependent on legacy media for his analysis. And he's one of these guys who literally just sits there, reads paragraph after paragraph from the AP or the New York Times to, you know, inform his audience about. So there is a demand there. There is a demand for real news and so on. It's just a matter of how do news organizations assert themselves and better assert themselves. One of their biggest mistakes, I think, I'm not as black-pilled as some of you guys are, but like one of the big mistakes that I think is still somewhat rectifiable, and some news organizations are trying to like rectify, you cannot let these large language models take your content. No, no way. I mean, I would basically put a halt to that. The biggest mistake was giving Google and so much leeway with Google and all these search engines.
Facebook. I mean, Facebook was hugely, hugely damaging, I think.
As news organizations and civic activists, I think one project that is still doable is just dismantle, you know, do what the Europeans are starting to do with these big tech companies and with these oligarchs, is just targeting them.
Yeah, but good luck. I mean, like I've done some serious. I wrote a Harper's cover story on this. That's just not happening. I mean, like the DOJ has just been repeatedly told not to enforce antitrust law. And like Lina Khan is okay, but as I think I've said on this show before, we need 50,000 Lina Khans. I mean, the problem is that when you look at the progressive era, when something like this did happen, there was super majoritarian support for like this transformative project. But now we're basically a country divided down the line. Both parties are essentially deregulatory and have deregulated. I mean, it was Clinton who signed the Telecommunications Act of 96 into law. It was Clinton who basically ended financial interest and syndication rules that essentially prevented the conglomeration of Hollywood. It was Obama who encouraged the ZERP program that essentially gave media corporations the money to buy every other media corporation, so that every Universal owns whatever 20 net, whatever it is, I forget the exact number. So like what I say on the show all the time, like we know the solutions, but there's just no political constituency to actually do that, especially because we live in a political system that has by design limited both congressional and public ability to shape policy. So like that to me is the problem. Like the solutions are relatively simple: anti-monopoly, regulation, wealth tax. During wars, we've even had price gouging laws. There's no reason you can't have price gouging laws. Costs have far outstripped inflation. But the question is, why has none of that happened, right? It's not like a difficult thing to know what to do, but it's a question of politics, and that's where my black pilling, I guess, comes in, as someone who has like studied this for a variety of perspectives for at this point, sadly, decades.
I mean, the Europeans are starting to do it, and you know there seems to be some momentum at least this year for voting in the primaries on the part of Democrats. Get some of the establishment Dems, get the Chuck Schumers and his allies out of office, and as well as voting in the midterms as shown. So I think that is, you know, there's a possibility there. There's a model there. You yourself say that there is a model there and people know what to do. The Europeans are doing it. You know, look at and it's wonderful to see the reaction of the tech oligarchs just because the French and the Spaniards and the Australians want to protect their kids from, you know, pornography and pedophiles and groomers on the websites. They are basically, and I have a kid, I'm in Paris now, and I have a kid in school here, and this is super popular with the people here. So if you had a, you know, candidate in the primaries and saying that we need to put a ban, maybe not 16, maybe at least 14 and below can't use social media and real age verification. And I know there's a lot of privacy complications with that and so on. if they could implement that and propose that, maybe that is a way out of just, you know, preventing these figures from completely running roughshod of over all of our civic institutions that they see as impediments to their power. And those civic institutions include news outlets, including legacy news outlets.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
So I do want to talk a little bit more about the political elements of this, because I think once you get past the bottom line, there are political decisions being made here. But I also wanted to ask you, we're like still talking about the disconnection between, or the increasing disconnection, I guess, between hot takes and actual things that are happening on the ground. I saw on X the other day, like you mentioned that there is, I guess, apparently, I hadn't seen this, but there's a growing market in the commentary about Iran universe, that Iranians want to go back to Zoroastrianism. And like this, there's obviously no reporting that could back this up, but it's a symptom of this, like increasingly just having somebody in the U.S. write a hot take about Iran, like, oh, they all hate Islam. They want to come back to, can you talk a little, just talk for a second about this? It's so absurd.
I mean, this is what you'll get when you have this vacuum of credible journalism. You have these people who, you know, claim to know, and they speak with such confidence about this is what's happening. They put out fake information about protests that took place the night before. I'm like pointing out there have been protests in Iran in a month, you know, and they're putting up video that, you know, is clearly from a month ago saying that the protests, don't let the people of Iran down. These protests are taking off again. They're starting again. And there'll be like 30,000, you know, likes and 2,000 retweets of this video, and it's just so much disinformation, so much clickbaity kind of engagement farming for the sake of their monetization strategies, so much just complete, like, potentially damaging information. I didn't want to talk about this too much, but I can just, you know, point this out, and it's a great illustration of what the dangers are. You know, I am Iranian American. I've covered Iran for, you know, more than two decades. I've gone to that country quite a bit. I lived there for a few years when it was still possible to live there. And, you know, people are saying like 86,000 people died in these protests. I mean, first of all, do you know anything? Were there airstrikes? You know, how do you kill 86,000 people in two nights? Like, it's like Dresden level, you know, catastrophe. First of all, just way too insane. Do I doubt that the Iranian regime has the capability of doing that? Absolutely not. No, they would kill a million people to stay in power. But like, you have to show me some evidence. And no, it's just, you know, and then the methodology that someone pointed out is like, well, I'm in Iran. Their account says they're in Germany or something. And I know four people who have died. If you multiply that by the number of people there are in Iran, if everyone knows four people who have died, it's like, what the hell? This is their calculatory model. And then I kind of point out, it's like, look, if you know something about Iran, as if having lived there and been a reporter there, you know that it's like a really bureaucratic system. It's almost like, you know, what you would imagine like a Soviet style system, where are your papers? You know, like everything is documented. Everything is kind of put out there. And one of the things that's super kind of evident about Iran, you see it on every you know, wall, is every death gets a notice. There's an advertisement. Every person who dies has a little poster that they put up in the little village neighborhood square announcing the date of the funeral service, the announcing the date of the seventh day afterward in which there is a ceremony, and then announcing the 40th day after that where there's another big ceremony. So it's like fairly painstaking, but quite possible to actually document the number of people who've been killed in the protests. And the people who know that have said 7,000. Now, it's like, does it really matter that 7,000 were killed versus 86,000. Does it affect policy? I think it does. I think that 86,000 is such a large number. It's more than, you know, Israel supposedly killed in Gaza. And it creates like this sort of policy momentum that is moving the country towards a war. Is 7,000, should it mean that it is less likely to move towards war? I don't know. I don't even want to get into that debate, but like, it does look like people are inflating the numbers, and the same people who are inflating the numbers are trying to goad the U.S. into a war that doesn't, it's another, you know, first strike regime change war of choice. So I think that's a really good example of where you need journalism to kind of unpack these things.
To stay somewhat in the Middle East and talk about the political decisions that go into these firings, and I want to talk about the Washington Post, because there's obviously an economic systemic, you know, thing happening where, you know, we've got to cut X number of jobs or cut X number of expenses to get to whatever bottom line we're looking for. But within that, when you have a newspaper based in the nation's capital that says, you know, we want to maintain international reporting to talk about U.S. national security, but they axed the entire Middle East desk, and this is a Middle East desk whose coverage of Gaza in particular, you know, got them. They were Pulitzer finalists for the Hind Rajab story. They had some pretty good reporting on the atrocities that were taking place in Gaza, and they're all gone. That's, to me, like, that, I don't think you have to, you know, read any tea leaves to see what's happening there. Or, you know, and coming after the decision not to, you know, when Bezos put his, you know, put his finger on the scale and quashed the Kamala Harris endorsement, and, you know, that started this chain reaction, I guess, of lost subscribers. Or when he made the decision to say our op-ed pages are only going to be devoted to things that, you know, extol the virtues of free market capitalism and nothing else. Like, it's there's some very political things that are happening here, right?
I would like to see evidence of that. I mean, there is a lot. It does seem like rather vengeful what he did to the Middle East coverage at a time when the Middle East is so crucial right now, as the U.S. is drifting towards you know, another regime change war, to just axe the entire Middle East desk. It seemed like an act of revenge. I don't know if, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, is there something else behind that other than economics? It's also, he also axed the Ukraine desk. I think it's just really expensive these days because of what I had pointed out with the insurance costs and the, you know, the security training costs and all of these unnecessary, in my mind, gratuitous expenses that are added on now as, you know, requirements by these bureaucrats that have been installed in positions of power at these news organizations. I think it's probably just, first thing he said is no more assignments in conflict zones. I thought that was interesting because when the first rumors of the impending cuts came, the first thing one of the things that was in there is that journalists have been asked not to go into any more conflict zones. And so I think that is probably linked to the expenses thing. But I would be very careful about, I don't know, Bezos, some of the things. Why is it a favor for I mean, it's a favor for Trump to finance the Melania movie. It is a favor to basically change the editorial line of the editorial pages. It's a favor to not endorse Kamala Harris. But why is, like, cutting the Middle East desk, which is, like, really respected in DC think tank circles and stuff, like, that's, you know, they're not that, like, radical. They published the names of some of the people who were killed in Gaza, but they also have been very, you know, aggressively covering the Israeli position. And they're, you know, not exactly, you know, it's not exactly electronic intifada, you know? So I don't see it as a, I don't see him particularly targeting that desk for political reasons versus just targeting conflict coverage in general, because it's so expensive now.
I guess maybe as a final question, taking this to this sort of absurd extreme, can you talk a little bit about what's going on at the Pentagon? This happened a while ago, but they basically told all the legacy media to get out of the building, and we're going to bring in, you know, like, podcasters essentially as the Pentagon press corps, and only if they sign
an agreement to like not do anything, to just sit in their little cubicle all day and wait for somebody to come and talk to them. Like, then, you know, don't ask any questions, don't chase anybody down for any leads, like just kind of sit there passively. Have you followed that? Like, what's been going on there? Because I'm aware of it, but I don't really know.
Even Newsmax was like, no way, this is crazy. We're not going to follow these rules. You know, I mean, you know your rules are, you know your rules are out there when even Newsmax is refusing to abide by them. But yeah, I mean, I think maybe it's a shame, you know. And I've done like a little bit of Pentagon reporting with colleagues when there was still that kind of collaboration at news outlets. And, you know, I mean, but the thing is, you don't really need to be at those press conferences. The whole charm of being in the Pentagon building was being able to walk around, same with the State Department, catch someone that you know, hey, how about we get a cup of coffee? You develop relationships that way. And so, yeah, it's going to impede the development of relationships. I don't see the coverage getting any worse or better since that has happened. I think that's kind of interesting. Like the Pentagon beat is just getting as many kind of scoops that have been coming out. You know, the Pete Hegseth thing, that he ordered the double tap on those poor fishermen in Venezuela. It came out after they tried to kick all these journalists out. So I think that people are still leaking. It's just harder, and it's harder for, you know, Pentagon officials who are potential whistleblowers and want to talk and, you know, put stories onto journalists and give them tip-offs for their own reasons, whether out of conscience or whether to, you know, knock the other person ahead of them in the ladder, off of the ladder. You know, whatever their reasons, it made it harder for them to, you know, step out of line. It made it more, it's easier to spot them at a cafe together and, you know, track their cell phones to see where they, you know, went, than if it's, everyone is just at the Pentagon whispering to each other.
Do you think there's a chance Bezos will purchase our podcast?
we are willing to talk, Jeff, if you're listening. Yeah.
Maybe if you insult him enough and say a lot of nasty things about him, he'll buy it just to crush it.
To close it off. Yeah,
that'd be great. That'd be like getting free. That'd be amazing. Yeah.
I think these guys have become such sociopaths. I mean, WTF, like these people have just gone completely insane. They're like this gang of Bond villains. You know, I mean, like, how will history judge this time when we basically handed the keys to our future, to our educational systems, to our children, to these six or seven psychotic oligarchs? And I guess the, you know, NVIDIA guy is the least insane of them. He seems the most normal human being. You know, and how are we, you know, Jensen Huang, but these other guys, Zuckerberg, they're like mutants, you know, living on these islands and building bunkers and so on. It's like the stuff of science fiction. These people need to be brought down to size. That should be like a societal priority. We need to collaborate as societies with Europe to just cut these people down, destroy. I'll get Bezos to buy you off now to crush you. But like, these people need to be destroyed. They need to be imprisoned. They need to be investigated. Their lives need to be turned into a living hell. Their companies need to be, you know, definitely SpaceX needs to be expropriated. You said you're the commie. So, but like definitely, and then their companies, Google and Chrome, need to be separated. You know, this is the kind of things that antitrust regulators in Europe are talking about. Not just Europe, you know, effing India is doing a better job confronting these tech companies through their regulators than the United States is right now. It's pathetic. You know, even they are like standing up to the tech companies in a way that our regulators are not.
So, Borza, my actual final question to try and end on a somewhat hopeful note. You mentioned a couple of places that people should check out in terms of outlets that are trying to do good reporting around the world. Can you talk about those? And, you know, if there's a hope for this, it's going to come, I guess, out of one of the models that, you know, these places are trying to pioneer.
You know, I have like goldfish memory, so I can't remember all of them. But like there's the Ground Truth Project, which is
that
really
was one.
Interesting.
Internews, yeah. And the New Humanitarian.
Yeah, Internews, yeah. The New Humanitarian, the UN one. But there's many more. And I like look through them And there's different initiatives, there's different ways of, you know, I mean, maybe it would be some kind of Substack conglomerate, you know, of people who are different correspondents in different areas. Maybe someone organizes something like that and comes up with a, you know, model, revenue sharing model for those people. And like, you know, I mean, that would be cool. I think that's kind of what you guys are somewhat trying to do. And I think that's really cool as well.
So once again, American Prestige, the only way to save society. You heard it here first, folks. Thank you so much, Borza. We'll leave it there for now, but this has been really great, and we would love to have you back anytime.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. You guys have a great week.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.